Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
Hi everyone, this is James and Dan. We are two-fourths of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right, every week we sit down behind some microphones and share with each other the best things we've found out over the last 7 days.
Yes, so for instance, Dan, did you know that you cannot tie a knot in 4 dimensions?
I knew that's where I was going wrong. Interesting.
There are all sorts of reasons why, but we would go into them all on our podcast, along with loads of extra facts as well.
That's right. And if you want to check it out, No Such Thing as a Fish is available wherever you get your podcasts.
I have some libertarian friends who probably think they shouldn't have to have a library card to take books out of the library. They've already paid their taxes. They want the books. No, you got to have a library card. It's free.
Okay. Let me push back by asking you a question. Welcome to How to Fix It. I'm John Avlon. Now, one of the biggest problems facing our country today is polarization, hyperpartisanship. I've devoted a lot of my career to combating that. One of the solutions is something called fusion voting. Now, you may not have heard of it because it only exists in a handful of states, but it used to be more or less the norm. But since then, the two-party duopoly has been doing everything it can to stop it. And our guest this week is Dan Cantor. He's a founder of the Working Families Party, but he's also head of the Center for Ballot Freedom and has a new cover article in Democracy, Journal of Ideas, called Fusion Voting, Escaping the Two-Party Doom Loop. Dan, it's good to see you.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so just lay this out for folks. What is fusion voting?
Okay, so fusion voting is a system that was once legal in every single state in every single election of the 19th century. Was a fusion election in which minor parties were allowed to be constructive actors. Everybody thinks we have this two-party system and it's written into the Constitution or it's just in fact of nature, but in fact, it's not. It's a result of the rules that we have. And in a fusion legal system, it means that you can get out of the wasted vote and spoiler box that makes third parties either irrelevant or counterproductive. Something like 75% of Americans say that they don't believe the two-party system is working well and wish there were more than just two choices. But then it doesn't take them long. If you ask them, do you think third parties have a chance? They say no, because I don't want to cast a vote, a wasted vote or a spoiler vote. And there, you know, it gives you some heart. The citizens actually understand that the system is rigged pretty firmly in favor of just this duopoly you just mentioned. So in a fusion system, it means that a minor party, in New York, there are still two, a conservative party on the right and the Working Families Party that I was associated with for a long time on the left, that chooses between the two major party candidates, usually. You can still run a standalone third party candidate, but that's not a very effective thing. A smarter approach is to look at the two major party candidates and choose the one closer to your values. And what happens on election day, if you, Avlon, is running as the nominee of the Democratic Party, but also the Working Families Party, Working Families would say, well, vote for Avlon. He's pretty good. He's not perfect, but he's better than the other guy. And vote for him on the Working Families Party line and let him know you want him to be better on taxes or healthcare, or whatever the issues are that animates the minor party. The Conservative Party would say something else. And the Common Sense Party in Michigan would say something still different. But election day rolls around and you get 44% as a Democrat. I get 48% as a Republican, let's say. And the last, we'll do the math here, the last 8% comes in on the Working Families Party line for you. So the votes are tallied separately and then added together. You get 52% of the vote, 44% on the Democratic line, 8% on the Working Families Party line. And you win the election 52-48. But if you're a good politician, you'll notice, huh, that's interesting. I got 8% of my vote, kind of helped me get over the finish line. I'm going to have to pay attention to those people. And for the Working Families Party or, you know, the United Wisconsin Party, these are all new fusion parties that have formed in America. They feel pretty good. They can say to you, you have to pay attention to us. We're not just the same as the people who voted for you in your major party nomination.
It's a way of advancing ideas. It gives you know, voters who've got, you know, pluralistic ideas, heterodox ideas, a different home. It's sort of a version of a kind of the choice that's in parliamentary systems. I want to dial back here for a second, just pull the aperture back, because you mentioned a couple things that are really important. One, the Constitution of the United States does not mention political parties.
Not
an accident. I like the joke sometimes. It does mention journalists, but it doesn't mention political parties. George Washington did not want there to be political parties. The first Congress of the United States did not have political parties. It was the founders' original intent that people would come and represent their conscience and their constituents, not a partisan interest. And of course, Washington, in his The Farewell Address that I've written a book about, warned against the dangers of hyperpartisanship and polarization. And that's what we're seeing. So to your mind, And you're fighting for this and have lived this fight, fusion voting is an off-ramp. It gives a way to decrease polarization, to form new coalitions. And it's something that was standard and legal in American history until fairly recently. So what happened? How did the two parties effectively outlaw, in many states, what had been the norm? And what's the fight to bring it back? How does it stand?
Let me just start by saying George Washington was great, but he was wrong about this. You have to have parties in a democracy. There's no way for democracy to function without this building block. This is how we manage and structure political competition without recourse to violence, is we have parties. And they're a good thing. The problem is when you have only two, then you're in this zero-sum conflict where I can only win if you lose. So in the 1840s and 50s, let's assume one of your ancestors was an abolitionist. What can they do? You had a Democratic Party that was pro-slavery and a Whig Party that was mixed. And sometimes they had good people, some not. And you decide, well, I don't like these choices. What can you do? You could run, in some cases, the Liberty Party or the Free Soil Party was strong enough to run a standalone candidate if there was a really strong abolitionist sentiment. But if they couldn't, they were smart. They said, well, vote for Avalon. He's a Whig. He's not perfect, but he's better than his pro-slavery opponent. But vote for him under the Free Soil ticket or the Liberty Party ticket, or my personal favorite, the Anti-Nebraska ticket, and let him know, that's what they called their parties, let him know that you want him to be better on slavery. And if you get elected to Congress, and there were many such fusion candidates, the greatest senator in American history in some ways, Charles Sumner, was a Free Soil Democratic fusion senator. And he was able to carry in his mind, oh, I'm the nominee of these people, and I have to pay attention to both. So in today's, so it's every single election of the 19th century. After the Civil War, the Grangers and the Greenbackers and the Populists and the Suffragists and the Prohibitionists, they all were minor parties that in one part of the country or another would play an important role in injecting new ideas. For the populists, most famously, it was around monopoly and railroad regulation, things like that. For the suffragists, it was suffrage. For prohibitionists, of course, it was temperance, right?
So you advance ideas that might otherwise be isolated and inject them into the mainstream of politics via these fusion.
Absolutely. Parties. And new ideas almost always start with small groups of people who say, you know what, we need unemployment insurance or an end to child labor. And the major parties are not paying attention to this. Let's show them that there's a base for this. And if you get 5%, that's something. You get 10% of the vote on your line, that's even better. And in some cases, you'll get even 20 and 30% of the vote. So this is a way to inject new voices, new choices. It's not destructive. It's not wasting people's time or spoiling elections. It's allowing them to say, you need to pay attention to this other idea, these other values. And you know you're doing well when the major parties adopt your views. That's a sign of success. People say, oh,
it's being
coalition. I'm like, it incentivizes inter-party coalitions. Our current system punishes anybody who compromises. I mean, I'm obviously a man of the left, but my whole theory of the case is you want principled bargaining from people who don't agree on everything, but they might agree on enough things to make a deal. Making a deal is a good thing. We want government to succeed and being seen as succeeding in solving public problems. That's kind of the whole point. Right now, government is failing.
It's completely failing, and this is the real danger, because it decreases people's faith in democracy itself. The polarization is going unchecked, and now we've got, you know, an authoritarian enabling party that's disconnected from its own ideals. So, but, you know, and this is an idea I support. New York State still has fusion voting. It's been curtailed a little bit in recent decades. But how did it go from something that was commonplace in America? This is apple pie and motherhood. To really being hunted out of existence by the two parties pursuing their self-interest and at the expense of the public interest.
For most of the 19th century, elections were not administered by the government. They were administered by the parties. And so you would show up at election day with the ballot from the party you favored. Sometimes they were just published in newspapers. You'd snip them out and you'd drop them into the ballot box. In the 1880s, for some good reasons, the government took over the printing of ballots. There was a lot of corruption. There was vote buying and so on. And they standardized the printing of ballots and made it a governmental responsibility. And it wasn't long before the major parties realized, well, if we print the ballots, we can control who's on the ballot. And so what they did was they passed what are known in the historians, among the historians, as the anti-fusion laws, beginning in 1895 in Iowa. It takes about 20 years to pass it in almost every state. It even passes in New York, but somebody sued in New York in 1911. They passed the ban in 1910, and in 1911, somebody sued, and the New York State Court ruled that it was unconstitutional. And the reason they did that, the idea of the challenge, the legal challenge, is Avalon and his friends should have the right to form a party and nominate the candidate they favor under their own party label. What is the state's interest in preventing that, right? And the New York State High Court agreed with that. In most other states, they did not. They were, the courts were themselves very partisan, and they wanted to lock in the advantage of the two-party system. So they passed laws saying no candidate may appear on the ballot as the nominee of more than one party. So the third party, whether it was the populists or any of these many other third parties, faces a dilemma. We can stay true to our principles and run a standalone populist, which no one will vote for because people are not stupid, right? They're not.
It will be a spoiler.
Be a spoiler, or you can go over to the enemy camp. I mean, the populists and were very smart. They formed alliances with the Republicans in the South. In the North, the populist Democrat alliance was sort of the worker farmer alliance. And you might ask yourself, a listener might be wondering, why didn't they just form one party? And the reason was cultural. Democrats were urban, Catholic, lots of immigrants, and wet. They drank. And populists were native-born, Protestant, rural, and often dry. So culturally—
Wait, I want you to give one of the first shout-outs to Williams Jennings Bryan on the Bulwark. You know, just—
There you go.
Just to really just double down on the nerdishness.
The great commoner. So culturally, these things were very different from another. People are still culturally different from one another, but they agreed on enough things that they formed the so-called worker-farmer alliance. Even more amazing is what happened in the South. There, the dominant party was the Democrats, right? In the North, the Republicans are dominant. In the South, the Democrats, Jim Crow Democrats, are a dominant party. And there, the populists fused with Republicans, who in the South after the Civil War were mostly Black Republicans, right? That's who joined the Republican Party. So in North Carolina, there's this magnificent and tragic moment in which, you know, the children of ex-slaves and some ex-slaves themselves and ex-Confederates and their children united in a fusionism, they called it. An
alliance. There's a great recent PBS documentary about this, by the way, on the American experience that people should.
There totally is. It's called The Coup. It's about what happened after populists and Black Republicans fused. There was a coup, a violent coup against them. But for a brief moment, they ran the state government. The governor was elected by them. They spent money on schooling, including for Black children. They spent money on land reform, education funding. So it's a way for parties to unite. So people who agree on some things, but not everything, to unite. That doesn't happen in our system anymore. There used to be, throughout the 20th century, political scientists would say there were four parties inside the two parties, liberal and conservative Democrats, liberal and conservative Republicans, and they could make cross-party alliances on particular issues. But that's all gone. Stuff has been sorted, as you are well aware, into the two tribes. And if you're in your team, that means anything that helps my team hurts your team, and vice versa. And you're not allowed to talk to the people on the other team, because then you're betraying something. It's silly. It's not. It's juvenile. It's in some level, and it's easily fixed. The two party is an artificial construct of the anti-fusion laws. That's what keeps it. That's what prevents new parties from emerging. The United States is the only major country. This is a little factoid for the listeners of a certain kind. The only major country in which no new major political party emerged in the entire 20th century. We're going on 175 years now of the same two parties.
So I'm just finishing a book on Teddy Roosevelt. Obviously, there's the 1912 Progressive Party. And it, in some ways, it's a reflection of the need for fusionism. But because the Republican Party was split between the old guard conservatives and progressive Republicans, TR runs as a progressive. But that he functions as spoiler. He comes in second.
Taft he actually does very well for a third party candidate. At 27%, the all-time high.
Yeah, but it does sort of seal that deal, because it's not fusion, and it's all wrapped up in sort of the post Reconstruction racial politics, which is largely about control as well. So, what states currently have fusion voting? Who are the lonely left?
The lonely ones there still are Connecticut and New York State, and those are the only two states in which a candidate appears under two labels distinctly, meaning you can tally the votes separately by party and then add them together. There are some districts where a third party will get 25% of the vote, other districts 2.5% of the vote, right? Depends on who mm-hmm. do they have in that district, what kind of organization do they have. But there are no wasted votes and no spoiler votes when you're voting a fusion candidacy. It doesn't mean you're going to win every election. It just means that everybody is casting a meaningful vote. So most of the states banded, as I said, around the turn of the 20th century. Some took a long time. South Carolina didn't get around to banning it until 2023. That's South Carolina.
Well, that's a whole Dixiecrat deal. Yeah,
exactly.
But you're leading a fight to bring it back in several states where this is very much a live issue. So what's the current state of that fight?
I stepped down from the Working Families Party about 8 years ago now. And I have been devoted ever since to the project of trying to revive fusion voting. Once legal everywhere, now, you know, we're Americans. We're required to forget our history. And this is a little bit of more unknown American history. And there are efforts underway in probably seven states to try to revive it, different strategies. So this is just a law. There's nothing in the Constitution of any state that bans fusion voting. It's just a statute that was passed in most cases about 100 to 125 years ago. Very simple statute saying what I said before: no candidate may appear on the ballot as the nominee of more than one party. Some version of that. Sometimes they have different language, but that's the intent.
This episode of How to Fix It is brought to you by Pocket Hose, the world's number one expandable hose. Okay, so old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's pocket pivot swivels 360 degrees for a full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home and, more importantly, backyard. When you're done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. The brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with pocket pivot is a total game changer for your backyard, for your gardening, for your flowers, and all that jazz. I know how much garden hoses can feel like a waste of space in your shed or your garage, but this hose goes from pocket size, and it really does. I've got one. It's crazy. From pocket size to full size in seconds. It's amazing. And when you're done, it actually shrinks back down and coils up like magic. So that means no winding, no hassle. And that's a time saver. Appreciate that. Trying the pocket hose. I am personally never going back. This hose is lightweight and durable, and watering the yard is now a dream. For a limited time, my listeners can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text FIXIT, all caps, FIXIT, to 64,000. That's FIXIT to 64,000 for your two free gifts with your purchase. Fix it to 64,000. Message and data rates may apply. See terms for details.
I want to punctuate something here because it's really important. You mentioned a stat earlier, the most recent number I'm aware of, Gallup poll, 67% of Americans saying they wanted another choice in the ballot. But 45% of Americans self-identify as independent. Now, there's all sorts of academic arcana, particularly our friends in the Beltway who bend over backwards trying to say that that's not happening. But even in states that have registered independent votes, where you can register independent or blank, those numbers are fairly consistently growing while the two parties are flatlining or declining. So there's a demonstrated need or desire for something different and a recognition, and you and I probably disagree about the reasons why. I think it's not a coincidence it's happened as the two parties have become more polarized. But there's a market failure in our politics. Oh, yeah. And the rising number of people registering as independent is a reflection of that. There's an unmet demand.
I completely agree. I mean, it really is a market failure. And in a healthy, functioning market, if 45% of the people are saying, oh, we don't like either of the two choices, some entrepreneur would say, well, my choice, you should come with me. They can't do that in the American system, right? Because the third party, when there's only one winner in a race, that's what people, you know, our single member district system, that inevitably produces two main parties because it's the math. A third party is always going to be stuck in that wasted vote or spoiler box. Every now and then, you know, a Jesse Ventura, who's a celebrity, can break through and win an election in a three-way election. But it is vanishingly rare.
We've had a few, right? Angus King, two-term independent governor of Maine, Jesse Ventura, Lowell Weicker, who was basically a liberal Republican mainstay in Connecticut. Alaska has a tradition of independence, but it's vanishingly rare, and it really only works for executive races, not legislative
Correct.
Races.
And it doesn't build an organization. This is where you and I might disagree, but not much.
I'm pretty sold on the fusion idea and ideal. I think there are exceptions.
The big opportunity is in the center. Right now, there is a giant number of people. I mean, the people who are bringing these cases, so in Wisconsin, in Kansas, in Michigan pretty soon, New Jersey, there are groups of...
So go through the seven states for people, Dan.
So just the ones that are furthest advanced, meaning litigation has been brought in New Jersey, Kansas, and Wisconsin. Michigan looks likely to be up soon, we hope. And there's a couple more, you know, legal feasibility memos. You need a good state constitution and you need a good state court to bring one of these cases. By a good state constitution, I mean something with good language around freedom of speech and freedom of association. These are not being brought under the federal constitution. These are being brought under each state's own.
Can I ask why? Because, I mean, the federal constitution is pretty clear about freedom of speech and assembly. I know these are state laws because of our federal system, but.
No, that's not the reason. The reason is this court is too hostile to the freedom of association, this particular court. And there was a court case 30 years ago that I was involved in that tried to do it at the federal level. It was rejected. It was the Rehnquist court, and Rehnquist ruled, and I think not one of his shining moments, that even though he agreed that it was discriminatory against the minor party, it was a minor party called the New Party, Twin Cities Area New Party, and he ruled that, yes, it was true that this hurt the minor party, but they could still do everything a party does except nominate candidates. It's like,
let me belabor the point. What else does a party do? What is the function of a party if it can't nominate candidates? What's Rehnquist's twisted logic? And maybe it would have been different if it was sort of a, you know, he was a, he famously drafted the decision for Goldwater that the Civil Rights Act was not something that libertarians should support. But
he took the view that the Minnesota, in this case, that's the state it came from, had an interest in what he called the stability of the two-party system. We do not have a stable system. We have an inert, brittle system that is failing us, right? So I suppose 30 plus years ago, maybe you could have said the two-party system is functioning reasonably well. There are still cross-cutting alliances, cross-party, but beginning with the Gingrich era, that's really going away and everybody sorts into their corners. So in these three or four states that I mentioned, there's litigation underway. There are a couple of other states where people are looking at potential legislative approaches. Very hard to imagine doing it legislatively, but maybe.
What states are those? You know,
I don't really want to say because I don't want to get ahead of people there.
But okay, fair
small
enough.
Groups, you know, people are strategizing and they should continue to do that. But we're optimistic. We had oral argument in Kansas 2 weeks ago. That was, you know, quite exciting. I think in Wisconsin, the court briefs are due in a few months. I think April 1 for one side and July 1 on the response briefs. So we'll know over the next year or two whether the courts at the state level agree with us that
in Wisconsin's case, I mean, they've got, you know, historic precedent with La Follette progressive Republicans. That's very much part of their political culture.
We're very optimistic about the Wisconsin Constitution and the Wisconsin court, but human beings are human beings. So they're going to make their, you know, you put your best foot forward. We think the need for it could not be more apparent. And the challenge for us is justices will often say, well, we ought to let this is a political question. We ought to let the legislature decide. That's a reasonable view. The legislature should decide, but sometimes they're not going to. You know, the Texas legislature, they should have known the whites-only primary was unconstitutional, but they needed a court to tell them. And the same thing is true with the anti-fusion legislation. It was passed by the two major parties. I rest my case. You should be the judge.
Let's just double down on the absurdity of this, right? I mean, this is like foxes voting on whether hens should get a vote. The parties are invested in the status quo because everybody has benefited from it to get to the legislature. And this is why you see when there's redistricting reform, which God knows we need. And it has been, it passes almost always through ballot initiative, through people power, not the parties. And usually the parties try to undo it as fast as they can because they don't want to open up the franchise. They want independent voters to be functionally disenfranchised. So the idea that this is going to come through a legislature, that's just clueless.
Yeah, well, yeah, you should get on the Supreme Court in one of these states quickly. This is what the state will argue in each case, and this is what the state argued in this recent hearing in Kansas. And we think we have a good answer to it. Yeah, that's true in theory, but in practice, it's what you said. You're asking the people who benefit from keeping the system the way it is to change it. It's why it's very hard to get campaign finance reform passed, anything to do with money in politics. If you're in office, it means by definition, you succeeded and you're a master of the universe. And so we're trying to say this system of ours is failing us. We are not solving public problems. That's the point of government. And we've got to get out of it. I don't want to overclaim. Fusion is not some magic thing that's going to completely solve every problem. Proportional representation is probably even better, but it's at hand.
Something that many states had in the past too, including Illinois, fairly recently.
A version of it. But I think I'm on stable ground to say there's no way we could have a worse system. I mean, this is so dysfunctional. The only thing worse would be a one party system, a dictatorship, and some people seem to favor that. But in any case, we still think there's a lot of support.
I'll give you a good line that comes from David Frum. I like giving people credit. Said at once that our system has all the disadvantages of a parliamentary system with none of the advantages.
Yeah.
There's a lot to that. That's what you're describing.
Political scientists sometimes call our system pre-modern because it was very early. I mean, we should give the founders some credit, right? The whole notion of proportionality in politics doesn't emerge until the 1840s or 1850s, I think, in Germany. So they did the best they could. They made these single member districts, division of, separation of powers. It turns out it relies on norms as much as anything else. We're all learning. But it's not a good system in terms of incentivizing two things. I want a system that incentivizes bargaining and compromise. And I want a system that incentivizes the citizenry to get organized. You want people to be in parties. Politics is a team sport. It's not an individual sport. So the idea of a party is people of like mind get together and say, okay, we want to advance these values. And the thing that the fusion organizer says all the time is the same thing, because I said it for 20 plus years. Vote for the candidate you prefer under the party label that best expresses your values. That's a powerful thing for a voter. They like that. Oh, I'm sending a message with my vote. And it's good for the elected if he wins or she wins, because they know, 22% of my vote came in under this other party's label. I need to be respectful and understand what they're interested in. And a good politician will say, I was glad to take the Common Sense Party's nomination. I don't agree with them on everything, but I agree with them on enough things, and we're going to work together to, you know, advance towards a more perfect union.
A more perfect union. I mean, what you just said, this encourages civic engagement, not apathy. It encourages compromise and coalition building. That's the lifeblood of democracy. And the current view, which says it's my way or the highway, this zero-sum, hyper-partisan, polarized system, is not working. It's a way to empower extremes at the expense of what I see as the moderate majority of Americans. And so this is urgent. And that's why I admire your fight.
I appreciate that very much. It is urgent. We are not going to solve this crisis without some kind of rules reform. The rules are crucial in all aspects of life. And so we need better rules. If you have better rules, you'll get better outcomes. And that is something we ought to be in favor of.
You change the rules, you change the game. So I want to talk about your personal journey because it's fascinating. And I think you and I are a great example of, you know, I think we've hurt our politics by looking for unanimity as opposed to understanding and finding out where you can create coalitions. You are a self-described man of the left. You helped found the Working Families Party in New York, which exists in other states, but most famously in New York, kind of a counterweight to the Conservative Party, which was created by William F. Buckley in the mid-1960s. For a long time, there was sort of a centrist fusion party. First was the Liberal Party. They would endorse candidates from both parties, and the Independence Party. Those no longer exist. But the purpose of the Working Families Party, as I see it, and tell me where I'm wrong, was sort of twofold. One, you were very early on focusing on the issue of affordability for working families. It was also the idea that the Democratic Party wasn't far left enough, and you would be sort of a pressure group on the left to keep Democrats moving left. But it does seem over the last decade or so, you've had perhaps not a change of heart, but your perspective has changed, because in many of the states where you're working to do this, what seems to be needed or you're advocating for is in effect a centrist third party to break the polarization. So tell me if I'm right, and then tell us about your personal evolution on this front.
I'm from Levittown, Long Island, America's most famous suburb. My parents were sort of traditional New York Jewish liberals, FDR, picture of Eleanor Roosevelt, so on and so forth. And I still believe that, you know, the purpose of government is to make life better for everybody, not just, you know, those who are, you know, fortunate enough to be born fortunate. But so I never really met any Republicans. Turns out there's a lot of these moderate Republicans. They're very nice people. They love their country too. And
yes,
they need a political home and a political identity. And when the light bulb goes on, so I've spent these last years meeting with and talking and trying introducing people to this idea of, well, if you could build your own political home and identity, and they instantly say, that's a waste of time. I said, that's true, unless you can change the rules to allow yourself to build this kind of fusion party. Remember, you're not trying to win the election just on your line. You're more realistic. But if you get 5%, 7%, 9%, you build power slowly. And it takes time to build an organization in power. So I feel like these are patriots. They really want to have a country that works for everybody, not where the main goal is to exterminate your opponents. It's to, you want to win, and then you want to bargain with them, and you want to make progress as best you can. Like, politics is not all of life, but it's a good part of it. Can be an incredibly noble pursuit. It's hard,
particularly in a democracy, which we shouldn't take for granted.
Absolutely. So, yeah, it's been really interesting for me. I still vote on the Working Families Party line in New York, where I live. But I am helping people form something called United Wisconsin in Wisconsin. This is very much a party of led by old school Republicans, non-MAGA Republicans. There's millions of such people. It's a solid third of the Republican Party. Here's a way to really understand the distortion of a two-party system is to look at Germany, of all countries. In Germany, there's a MAGA party called AFD.
The AFD. Familiar with it. Alternative, which is very, very Trump friendly for the most part.
Very much so. And last year, they got 21% of the vote in the German elections. And under their system of proportional representation, that 21% of the vote converts into about 21% of the seats in the Bundestag, in their Congress. In America, MAGA is 20% of Americans in poll after poll. They've never topped 20, between 19 and 20. Let's call it 20%.
I thought it was 25, but okay.
No, I think it's about 20. And I acknowledge that I am MAGA. That 20% converts into almost 60% of the Republican Party primary electorate.
Yeah.
And that gives them total control. So in Germany, 21%, pretty good, but a long way from 51. In America, 20%, a minority faction of the country, is in total charge, waging war on its own people. That is only possible because of the way the two-party system distorts the various beautiful hue of all these different kinds of views and forces people into just two boxes. I can only win if you lose. It's a bad way to run a country.
It's a terrible way to run a country. It is crippling self-government because it's not leading to the kind of constructive compromise and coalition building that is at the heart of a functioning democracy.
This episode of How to Fix It is brought to you by Mint Mobile. Are you one of those people who actually likes your money? Well, unfortunately, big wireless carriers like your money too. I switched and it was ridiculously easy. You get 3 months premium wireless from Mint Mobile for just $15 a month. So if you're tired of spending hundreds on crazy high wireless bills, bogus fees, and quote free, close quote perks that cost you more in the long run, well, then a premium wireless plan from Mint Mobile for $15 a month might be right for you. By switching to Mint, you could be saving a lot compared to the big wireless carriers and still getting the coverage you need. So stop overpaying for wireless just because that's how it's always been. Mint Mobile exists to fix that. Plan starts at just $15 a month, which still come with high-speed data, unlimited talk and text on the nation's largest 5G network. You keep your phone number activate with eSIM in minutes and start saving right away. No long-term contracts, no hassles. So if you like your money, Mint Mobile is for you. Shop plans at mintmobile.com/fixit, all caps. That's mintmobile.com/fixit.
So do you think there's a moderate R base for such a party in America, moderate R and moderate Ds together? What's your view?
My view for a long time has been that the center left and center right share far more in common than they do with the extremes of their own parties. But my view also is that we have demonstrably asymmetric polarization. What does that mean? It's a fancy term for the idea that the far right is in control of the Republican Party and the Democratic Party is basically split between moderates and liberals and very few folks who are on the far, far left. I think when the parties become dominated by their most extreme wings, which they can, particularly in very blue or very red areas, that leads to really unrepresentative outcomes. So I have always believed that we need more coalition building. We should have a centrist party option through fusion voting, because I think spoilers do have a disastrous effect. But we need to do everything we can structurally to strengthen American democracy for the 21st century. And that starts with combating hyperpartisan polarization. And I think ending the rigged system of redistricting and fusion voting and open primaries are the key ways to do this. And I think fusion voting is the one least understood, even though it's the one that has the most American tradition, as you point out.
It has that. And for my money, it has the most potential to solve the problem. I don't agree on, I feel like the problem, 75% of the Freedom Caucus comes from states that already have open primaries. That is not an advertisement for moderation. It's like, what's needed here is a better, if you have a systemic problem, any systems analyst would say, well, you need a systemic solution. And ours is a party system problem deep down. And we need, this is not the only party system solution, but it's nope. One that I think is especially worthy of your listeners' attention.
Can I ask you something? The Working Families Party, obviously very focused on issues of inequality for a long time. We have closed partisan primaries in New York, but fusion voting, right? Yeah. Although right now the two fusion options are I think fair to say, far right and far left, conservative working families.
But within the bounds of normal discourse, the conservative.
No. I'm not comparing it to the AFD. I mean, within the American system, right? There's nothing, nothing wrong with people in either coalition there. I'm just trying to describe it within a bell curve.
And there was sometimes a centrist party, but it's gone out of existence for the.
But it's gone out of existence for the time being. Yeah, exactly. Sort of a bad deal that we can get into relatively recent. We've got 1.1 million independent voters in New York City, around 2 million statewide, disproportionately voters from communities of color under the age of 40. Would the Working Families Party, you think, just as a matter of principle, you don't run it anymore, why wouldn't they support open primaries to enfranchise those voters when those numbers are going up and the two parties are flatlining?
Because they would argue, I believe correctly, that those voters should join the party they want to be part of. There's no cost to joining a political party in America. You just register in it and you are permitted the full range of involvement. Political party's role is to pick its standard bearer, its leader for that it wants to lead into public discourse. That should be done by the people who share those values, and they demonstrate that by joining the party. I have some libertarian friends who probably think they shouldn't have to have a library card to take books out of the library. They've already paid their taxes. They want the books. No, you got to have a library card. It's free.
Okay. Let me push back by asking you a question.
Hi, everyone. This is James and Dan. We are two-fourths of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. Every week, we sit down behind some microphones and share with each other the best things we've found out over the last 7 days.
Yes. So, for instance, Dan, did you know that you cannot tie a knot in four dimensions?
I knew that's where I was going wrong. Interesting.
There are all sorts of reasons why, but we would go into them all on our podcast, along with loads of extra facts as well.
That's right. And if you want to check it out, No Such Thing as a Fish is available wherever you get your podcasts.
Why do you think the numbers of independent voters, not only nationwide, but let's stay in New York, are going up so dramatically at a time when party registration is falling? And don't say we need a stronger party system. That's granted. I just mean, what do you believe is driving the growth of independent voters at a time when the parties are having trouble getting people to enroll, even though it's free and open?
I'm two things, I think, and I'm definitely no expert, but one is parties do not seem to be vibrant places that are functioning well, and they have a bad reputation. The two-party system is failing. Why do I want to be part of that? And then this whole world, this new media ecosystem we all inhabit, and social media, and people getting, deluged with stuff about on the same topic. So I think I think there's a big opening in a multi-party system. Lots of those people would find their way to a political home. Some people just are not that interested in politics. They don't want to, I don't want to be with anybody.
And that's independent voters, right. We should say, it's a bell curve. It's not monolithic. I will say, though, independent voters' growth predates social media fairly considerably.
True. I mean, I'm very interested. I was talking to a young woman the other day about, she was talking about, we need a youth party in America. I'm like, oh, that would be a good thing. You know, a youth party in a fusion system. In a fusion system, I think young people would flock to it. We're going to support the candidates who are going to make, not give everything to the boomers, that are going to save a little bit left for us, so to speak. So
okay,
I just feel like we need a multi-party system, not, your proposal to just open up the system to independent voters won't change anything. It continues loop.
I think it's really important just to understand. I think we need redistricting reform, open primaries, and fusion voting. And you could say, therefore, we need semi-open. I just don't think there's any logic for having taxpayer dollars go run for elections that people can't participate in.
They choose not to by not joining a party. It's a party primary. It's an organization. The state parties are unique. They're private organizations that the state is saying you have an important role to play in our society, because we want there to be factions, but we want them to, because that's, there's no way to
so
manage
you would support,
competition otherwise.
You would support, in the spirit of left, right, center representation, then a effectively a centrist third party in New York State again.
I think there should be one. I'll still vote Working Families.
Of course you will. You founded it.
It would be, co-founder, but anyway, it would be healthy for there to be a, you know, most democracies have between three and five parties. So we could do with one on the left, one on the right, two big ones in the middle, and then a centrist one. That would only be good. And the center one, by the way, would have a lot of juice, because the way it goes will be the most decisive of all in determining outcomes. The problem with the
100%.
Centrists is they never had to do much organizing over the long years in which they were the dominant force. So they they have to develop those muscles, I believe. And fusion will incentivize them to develop it, because they can see their way. We do not have to be majoritarian from the start. We can grow slowly and win and do it again and do it again and do it again. Nothing is solved once and forever.
And this is where you and I find a great deal of common cause. Before we go, and I think I want people to recognize they can find you at the Center for Ballot Freedom. Sign up for your newsletter. You're engaged in a lot of really important court cases right now. This is bigger than personal politics. This is about defending our democracy. I did notice you recently published a blog post, and I love me some politics, pop culture overlap, but praising Borgen. Tell people what Borgen is and why you recommend it.
So Borgen is a TV show that came out, I think, about 15 years ago. It's a Danish television show. So you have to read the subtitles.
On Netflix, I think, now.
Okay. Yes, I think that's right. And it's about a woman who leads the moderates in Denmark. And unexpectedly, she's thrust into the position of prime minister. And it's about, what is it like to actually have the parties bargain with each other over policy, over personnel, over all these things? It's like, it makes politics look really interesting and quite principled, but also the nitty gritty stuff that goes on behind the scenes. So it's really very entertaining and quite educational. And you'll walk away thinking that looks like science fiction compared to what we have in the United States, where all it is sound bites denouncing your enemy. And then you go, go off to a fundraiser. This is so much more interesting.
We're living through something very dystopian now. And what I appreciate about the work you're doing in the upcoming court cases in states like Michigan and Wisconsin, and you've already had a court case in Kansas, is you're proposing a solution. And it's bigger than your own personal politics. You're thinking structurally about what's best for our democracy. And for that, Dan Cantor, I salute you. And thank you for joining us on How to Fix It.
Thanks very much.
Hi, everyone. This is James and Dan. We are two-fourths of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. Every week we sit down behind some microphones and share with each other the best things we've found out over the last 7 days.
Yes. So, for instance, Dan, did you know that you cannot tie a knot in four dimensions?
I knew that's where I was going wrong. Interesting.
There are all sorts of reasons why, but we would go into them all on our podcast, along with loads of extra facts as well.
That's right. And if you want to check it out, No Such Thing as a Fish is available wherever you get your podcasts.